Good morning. We're going to go ahead and open up an informational hearing for the Senate Committee on Judiciary and go ahead and let the House do the same.
House will open the informational hearing on sex offender registration.
So I want to thank everyone that's here. We're on a very tight timeline, so we're going to go ahead and get started. I can tell you some of my members will not be able to make it based on other obligations, but I expect a couple will be trickling in later. It looks like on this informational hearing, Josh, I believe you're going to start off.
Morning. For the record, Joshua Nasby. I'm a deputy of the Legislative Council's office. Here this morning, Council asked me to give you a brief description of the law applicable to sex offenders. And so I put together a memo yesterday. I believe you all have it. What I plan on doing today is spending about 5 minutes going through the first two pages of the memo. The last five or so pages are my attempt to describe in an accessible manner what the sex crimes are in this state. So it's just kind of a shorthand description. I hope that's helpful. I don't plan on spending any time with that unless you have specific questions. The other kind of caveat I want to put on the record is this is an interesting time of the year in terms of describing what the law is. It's literally changing day by day. So I haven't made an effort to kind of survey the bills that are kicking around the building and incorporate those into the presentation with an exception or two. All that being said, I think we start with the general rule in Oregon law that a person convicted of a sex crime or adjudicated in juvenile court of a sex crime is required to report as a sex offender. That's a lifetime obligation. It's at least once a year within 10 days of the birth date. And I think there are kind of four exceptions to the general rule that everybody has to register as a sex offender. The first one is enrolled Senate Bill 408. I believe the governor signed it last week. Kicks in January 1 of this coming year. And that excludes persons adjudicated in juvenile court for a misdemeanor sex crime from the obligation to report. So juveniles in juvenile court adjudicated for sex crime, a misdemeanor sex crime, will no longer have to report as of January 1, 2012. The second exception is a law passed in 2007. It excludes folks from reporting if victims at least 14, offenders within 5 years, and the only sex crimes that the offender has involved that same victim. I've heard it referred to as a Romeo and Juliet law. I don't have a position on that, but if that rings a bell, that's what that series of statutes refers to. The second series of statutes, 181, 820, 823, and 826, are different mechanisms by which persons who have been convicted or adjudicated for a sex crime can petition a court for relief. Generally, in all three statutes, the standard is that the court has to find the person is rehabilitated and does not pose a threat to the safety of the public. The primary difference between these three statutes is in terms of when the person can apply for relief. So 820, which applies to circuit court convictions, as well as juvenile adjudications for a C felony, there's a 10-year waiting period. The other two statutes, 823 and 826, were amended in 408. They're juvenile specific, and the short version of those statutes is if it's a C felony, the juvenile can petition right at the very end of juvenile court jurisdiction for relief from the obligation to report. If it's an A or B felony, they have to wait at least 2 years before they can come into court and ask the court to relieve them of the obligation to report. And then the last exception is the statute obviously provides that if a conviction or adjudication is reversed or vacated or the person is pardoned, the person no longer has to register. So I think those are the four classes of exceptions to the general rule that that person's convicted or adjudicated for a sex crime or required to register for life. So that's the who. The when the person reports, general rule is initial report within 10 days of being placed on probation or released from a correctional facility. So there's kind of this, when the case is resolved, the person has to make an initial report. If the person doesn't live here, the initial report occurs within 10 days of moving into this state. And so once they've made that initial report, thereafter they have to report every time they change their residence within 10 days of their birth date. And there are provisions applicable to persons who work or attend an institution of higher education. And so they have to report when that work or school status begins and changes. Then there's also a provision that generally requires folks who don't live here but attend school or work in the state to report within 10 days of school beginning or the second week of work starting and a change in school enrollment or employment. So for the folks who don't live here but work here and go to school here, they have to report that fact. Where to report, I'm sure you've all heard this several times this session. Current law doesn't describe with particularity where the person is required to report. Just says to the Department of State Police, a city police department, or a county sheriff's office. House Bill 3204, which I think is still in the building, provides some specificity for that. And it also goes back and amends 408, which is which will be current law, but it amends that to incorporate these changes into the juvenile scheme. General rule is you report where your case is resolved unless you're out of unless your conviction or adjudication is out of state, and then the initial report is in Marion County. After that initial report, then the general rule is you report in the county where you last reported your residence. And again, that's contingent. This is all in 3204. 3204 does not pass. We've just got this blanket kind of in person to the department, police department, or county sheriff's office. What to report? There's a, the Department of State Police has adopted a sex offender registration form. Sex offenders are required to come in, fill that out. It's got basic information, address, work, vehicle, license plate, that kind of stuff. Offenders required to sign that, submit to photographing. The department or the law enforcement agency that's taking the report is authorized to photograph the offender at any time and any scars, marks, tattoos of the offender, that kind of thing. So that's the who, what, where, and when. The last thing I want to touch on is the dissemination of information. And I think what you don't see from looking at the statutes and what very well may be the most important use for this information is it all goes into LEDS, which is the law enforcement data system. And so police officers on the street have access to this information. And my sense is that if, and I'm going to just make up a hypothetical here, police officers get a call for a peeping Tom on a particular address, they could, you know, punch up in LEDS, see a sex offender lives across the street, and they might want to have a conversation with that person. So I think, although it's not reflected in the statutory scheme expressly, the most significant use of this information is on the street by police officers. The dissemination is interesting. The statutes are interesting. There are several rules that all kind of interrelate to each other. The first rule is that upon request, and I think that's important, law enforcement, or if the person is under supervision for the first time for a sex offense, the supervisory authority, is required to release any information that may be necessary to protect the public concerning the sex offender. So upon request, broad authority, anything necessary to protect the public can be released. The next kind of layer of dissemination is that the statute says the department can make available to the public without the need for a request by electronic or other means, sex offender information. And what I struggle with is what this electronic or other means means, because there's another provision that says you can't use the internet for that, you can only use the internet for these guys. And so I think at least the House heard testimony from the Department of State Police this session about these electronic files that they send out. And so I think that's how the department's resolved this without a request by electronic or other means. And again, that's because the use of the internet is limited to folks who have been determined to be predatory sex offenders, and the supervisory authority has determined they present a high risk of reoffending, or, and there's another whole classification for sexually violent, dangerous offenders. And so both of these determinations are made after conviction. There's a conviction prerequisite. The person has to have certain convictions. And then the supervisory authority has to find certain features, and so there's a footnote in the memo that describes what they are. But it's not an automatic kind of thing to make it on the sex offender registry on the internet. The supervisory authority has to determine that the person is, in a sense, dangerous. And so I think that's kind of the 10,000 feet picture. I'd be happy to answer any questions you have about this. And I'll just make myself available for the hearing if you have any questions.
Questions from anyone?
Josh, I have one. You mentioned about the birth date requirement to report within 10 days. Is it limited to 10 days prior to birth date or 10 days within?
My recollection is the statute says within 10 days, so I want to double check this, but I think it's either side.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Colette, I think you're up next with your team, so whoever you have with you.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Good morning, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Colette Peters. I'm the director of the Oregon Youth Authority, and we've been asked to appear before you this morning to provide an overview around juvenile sex offenders. And so I'll begin by providing an overview around OIA's population, general information regarding sex offenders, specific statistics around the sex offenders in the Oregon Youth Authority, specifically length of stay, their risk to recidivate, and then discuss some common myths around juvenile sex offenders. Then I'll turn it over to Ms. Debbie Martin, who's with us this morning, to talk specifically about the treatment at the Oregon Youth Authority. So as you all know, the Oregon Youth Authority serves the state's most delinquent youth. We have youthful offenders in our care and custody between the ages of 12 and 24. I hope I didn't do that.
They'll be right back.
All right, great. I'll continue. Yeah.
We're cleaning the slate. It wasn't quite.
So the offenders that we have in our care and custody are between the ages of 12 and 24, and for the most part, they have committed crimes prior to their 18th birthday. We have legal and physical custody of youth offenders adjudicated to the Oregon Youth Authority by the juvenile courts, and we also have physical custody of youth offenders sentenced by adult courts and placed with the Oregon Youth Authority. On any given day, we have approximately 2,000 youthful offenders in our care and custody, 1,100 in the community on either probation or parole, and then another 900 in our close custody facilities. This slide outlines for you the most serious crime that the offenders come to us having committed. As you can see, the majority of the sex offenders make up the majority or the highest amount of crime, excuse me. So the sex offenders in our care and custody are with us at about 31%. Now that's very different from our female population. The females come to us having committed property crimes, and the majority of the female offenders in our care and custody are very limited with a sex crime. So this next slide outlines for you nationally what the statistics look like. Generally, juvenile sex offenders range between the ages of 13 and 17. As I stated, they're typically male. Up to 50% have a history of physical abuse. Up to 90% have a history of sexual abuse. 30 to 60% have learning or academic difficulties, and up to 80% have co-occurring disorders. Now you'll see the statistics as it relates to the population at the Oregon Youth Authority mirror those statistics nationally. So the average age of our juvenile sex offenders is 15. Again, as I stated, 99% of juvenile sex offenders are male. And every 2 years, we conduct a mental health gap study and actually go through each offender's file to gain the following information. And what we learned in the recent mental health gap study was that 38% of our sex offenders have a history of sexual abuse, 13% compared to 13% for other offenders in our care and custody, 35% have a history of physical abuse, and that's compared to about 22% of the other offenders in our care and custody. The length of stay for juvenile sex offenders is consistently longer than other offenders in our care and custody. The average length of stay for juveniles committed for a sex offense has actually decreased by 22% from 2000 to 2009, and Ms. Martin will be able to talk about that in more detail, but it really relates to what we've learned about juvenile sex offenders, how treatment works while they're in close custody, and really focusing on having the right dosage of treatment for these offenders. So, recidivism. By crime category, sex offenders recidivate at a much lower rate than other types of offenders, both for our parole populations and probation populations. So, as you can see, our overall recidivism rate is at about 28% for any new crime, and sex offenders recidivate at approximately 18% for any new crime. If you look at our juvenile sex offenders committing a new crime, which is a sex offense, it's actually less than 4%. Over the past 2 years, we've really been working hard to rely on data and research to improve how we manage public safety and youth outcomes. And one of the new tools that we have created is a new risk assessment tool that we're referring to as the ORA. The ORA is a tool that predicts the likelihood a youth will recidivate with a felony inside 36 months of release from close custody or commitment to probation. Our research team has also created what we refer to as the ORA-V, and the ORA-V is a similar tool designed to predict violent felony recidivism. The ORA is incredibly accurate, and it correctly classifies youth as a recidivist or non-recidivist 72% of the time, and in the world of assessment tools, that's a very high accuracy rate. So we're pleased to be able to rely on this tool to help manage to making sure that we have the right offender in the right placement with the appropriate amount of treatment. Next, I'd like to talk about some myths around juvenile sex offenders. I think that the average public believes that most sex offenders are committed against strangers, and the facts tell us differently. The facts tell us that 11% of sex offenses committed by juveniles are against strangers. Another myth is that treatment does not work, and most sex offenders reoffend with a new sex offense. The data that I just showed you tells us otherwise. Youth who receive treatment recidivate at low rates. Juvenile sex offenders leaving OIA having received treatment recidivate, as I told you earlier, with a new sex offense at a rate of less than 4%. With that, if there are not any other questions, and if it pleases the committee, I will turn it over to Ms. Martin, who has served as OIA's Treatment Service Coordinator for sex offenders. She has a long history working with this population, both with the Oregon Youth Authority and the Lane County Field Office. But prior to coming to the Oregon Youth Authority, she was a juvenile counselor for the Clackamas County Juvenile Department and clearly has become an expert in managing juvenile sex offenders here in Oregon.
All right, just before we go there, Representative Wong, why don't you go some start?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Real quick question on the recidivism rate. It seems very low. Do we have data that indicates for us whether the low recidivism rate is because of the sex offender registry in Oregon, or in spite of that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wand, I don't have any data that correlates the low recidivism rate to registering. I think we do have research that indicates that providing treatment to these sex offenders lowers that future rate of recidivism. But I also don't have any research out there, Representative, that says that the sex offender registry doesn't contribute to a low recidivism rate.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Other questions? Call it before you go, before Ms. Martin starts, I want to go back to your last statement regarding the 4% recidivism, but compare that to the first slide that you had on the recidivism. There are two different charts. One shows OIA parole 36 month recidivism by crime at commitment, and compared to the one that says OIA probation. When I look at those, can you clarify what the difference is for the first one? I would say people that actually went into the facility that were at a youth facility, and they came out, and the sex crime for recidivism appears to be somewhere around 13-14% compared to those who do not go into a facility but are on probation, that theirs is down at 4%. Can you clarify that, please?
Mr. Chair, that is correct. So the first chart that you see is those offenders that came into a close custody facility and then were released on parole. And then the chart below actually describes those offenders that were adjudicated to our care and custody, placed on probation, and received treatment typically in an out-of-home placement, in a residential program, in a foster home, or in a Proctor home.
Okay. And could we make the, I guess, the nexus that based on the seriousness of the offense or their history is what would have put them into the closed facility as compared to being probation?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. And that's why you see that the percentage for those released into the community after having been placed in a closed custody facility is actually higher. And so we can conclude that their expected rate to recidivate was higher upon intake.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions for our colleague Peters? Ms. Martin?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, member of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to be here. Dedicated most of my career to working in this field, so I enjoy the opportunity to talk about this subject matter. I'd like to start with just a little bit of history about just general advances in sex offender treatment for juveniles over the last 25 years or so that it's been researched. What we know now, and some significant changes, is that we no longer treat juveniles as miniature adults. It used to be the thought that anything that worked with adults would work for juveniles and you can just apply it. We know now that that needs to be different and we are treating them differently. We have a better understanding of who they are. We know a little bit more about some of the motivations and their histories. You saw one of the slides from Director Peters about their history of abuse or some of their mental health conditions. We know more about who they are and how to better treat them. And that goes into the last understanding, is we better understand their treatment needs now. So we're able to better target exactly what they need so that we can have better outcomes. And we're constantly learning about what works better. So we know now what research supports is that a cognitive behavioral treatment approach is what's going to be best, give us the best outcomes. So if we can connect their thoughts and their feelings to their actions, then we're going to have the best outcomes. And that also that we need a more individualized treatment plan. All these juveniles are not the same. There isn't one definition of a juvenile who commits a sex crime. So we need to figure out what is most important for them as individuals. In addition, it used to be that group treatment was kind of the way to go, and now we understand that individual treatment as well needs to be combined with group treatment, that there are some aspects of treatment that are just better done individually as opposed to a group setting. So that's in addition to what we used to do. So to give a little history and development, knowing more about what works best for treatment, the Oregon Youth Authority decided we needed to have a curriculum that kept up with these new aspects and that we wanted it to teach skills and address treatment areas using that cognitive behavioral treatment approach. And so when we were looking around, we discovered there was no actual comprehensive program of that nature anywhere in the nation that we could find and just buy a product and implement here in Oregon. And so we decided we needed to develop that. And so we have undertaken that mission over the last probably 5 years or so. The curriculum is definitely intensive, but ultimately it is designed to decrease the length of stay. And it does that in a couple of different ways. One, we really identified that the curriculum that we're developing for our correctional facilities is one piece of the continuum of sex offender treatment services within juvenile justice in Oregon. So we decided we have a slice that we can do well in the correctional facilities, and then other aspects of treatment can be better done when they're in different settings in the community, whether that be community residential settings or foster care settings with outpatient treatment. So we're really looking at what do we do well in the facilities. We think we're on the right track to do that well, and then we can move them on and decrease their length of stay in the facilities. The curriculum is evidence-informed, so we're trying to reach that goal. Current research is being utilized to develop it. The Oregon Youth Authority contracted with Dr. Keith Kaufman, who is a professor of psychology at Portland State University, to create the and develop the curriculum. That's important to note because I think the Oregon Youth Authority wanted to do have the most solid product that we could have to treat this population. And Dr. Kaufman has national and international standing as an expert in the field of sex offense treatment and the prevention of sexual violence. So he was a nice fit for this product and is right here in Oregon as well. To give a little information about the specific content of the treatment program that we're developing, there's 8 modules included in that. The topics you see there, effective communication, not just day-to-day communication, but also communication about healthy sexuality and sexual content. Healthy sexuality, so think kind of like your high school sex ed, but a little bit beefed up. Societal influences, honor sexual beliefs, so what kind of messages are you getting from media and family members and such that shape your beliefs about sexuality, full disclosure of their sexual history, emotional regulation, how do they manage or cope with feelings and situations, patterns of offending, what can they learn about their behavior and how that repeats and what they can do to stop it. Victim awareness, so really having a good, solid understanding of how their behavior impacts those victims, and not just a particular person, but anybody in that circle or that ripple effect of their behavior. And also taking full responsibility, so beyond just stating the facts of what they've done, but really taking full responsibility for the harm that they've caused to their victims, to their family, and to the community. She also mentioned just briefly that we are also working on a transition curriculum that's under development to help transition the youth once they've kind of finished some core material in the correctional facilities to be ready for the community. So some topics about relapse prevention or dealing with societal barriers to their success. So that's underway as well. Just wanted to point out there are some specific treatment targets within those modules that I thought were important to highlight. We know that some treatment targets are directly related to risk for sexual recidivism. Those things include social skill deficits, lack of intimate relationships, and deviant fantasies. And those subject matters are woven throughout almost all of the modules to help them address those areas, because we know from research those are specifically tied to sexual recidivism, so we wanted to make sure to address those the best we could. I just wanted to highlight we've been underway with this pilot for some time now. One of the facilities that's undertaking that pilot is our Eastern Oregon Youth Correctional Facility. So just wanted to share a little bit about their experiences based on the new curriculum. All the staff are participating, not just those that are delivering the specific group or treatment, meaning that the entire facility, from the kitchen to the school to the maintenance, all worked around how do we schedule this treatment and how do we support this treatment. So the entire facility has gotten on board with this program. The staff that aren't delivering the groups are able to help with homework in the week, in the evenings, and help support and reinforce the new learning and the skills that they're getting in the group treatment. So the staff are really expressing that that's a new experience for them, and they're really enjoying being able to help and participate more in having the youth do their treatment rather than just kind of sitting back and not being involved. They're really enjoying that opportunity. Some of the youth reports from that facility is that they are feeling more prepared for when they're released. There was a young man that has been in and out of treatment in in the Youth Authority in different placements and programs for probably the last 4 years or more. And his kind of experience was that, all the treatment I've done, it's good. It's, I've talked about some of the stuff that's happened to me in my past, some of the issues that you kind of saw highlighted earlier, some abuse issues or trauma issues. He goes, but then I didn't really know what to do. So I talked about all that, and that was good. But then now what? When I get out now, what do I do? And he didn't feel like he was really prepared or he had the skills to behave differently. And he was expressing, now I actually feel like I have the skills to behave differently and to make different choices. So it's a really exciting thing to hear that it's something tangible that he can do differently. And that we're seeing that they feel more confident in their abilities and knowledge. Oftentimes youth are interviewed by probation or parole officers or new programs they might be going to, and you can really see a difference in how they're able to talk about their treatment and what they're learning from their treatment, and that it's very real stuff that they can use on a day-to-day basis. So the current status of where we're at with the treatment program is we've completed 6 of the 8 modules. There's still 2 that need to be developed. We've completed 2 of the 3 transition modules, 1 more to be developed there. All of that should be done by early next year is our goal. We're also refining new competency measures to measure differently what we want from the outcomes, what do we expect the youth to be getting from this curriculum as opposed to what we used to do. And just there is statewide support for this new curriculum. Lots of different programs, treatment providers out there have asked for this and are waiting and wanting to be a part of this. But there's also national interest. We've been getting calls for the last couple of years from other states around the country wanting this material. As soon as they heard that we were developing a comprehensive program and that Dr. Kaufman was writing it, we started getting calls. And so I think it speaks well to the product that we're going to have, that there's national interest, and it's going to be almost one of a kind. So that's really exciting for us. So that's what I have, and I'm certainly open to other questions along with Director Peters.
All right. First, sounds like or looks like Representative Tomei has a question.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So how long would the usually boys, how long would they stay in this program?
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, I would estimate the length of the program if they go beginning to end is about 1 year.
Okay, and follow-up, please. So the boy you mentioned who had been involved for 4 years, right? Mm-hmm. So tell me the process of that. What had he gone through?
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, I wouldn't know particularly all the different steps. I could give you an estimate based on other experiences. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes, youth that are committed to the correctional facility will do a period of time there. We think they're ready to transition into the community. They'll go likely to a residential treatment program.
Mm-hmm.
He probably had some struggles there, didn't do well, didn't comply with treatment or other rules and expectations. He may have been sent back to the facility for a period of time. That can happen on a back-and-forth basis, especially with our sex offending youth. They struggle with different rules and expectations in different ways, and because we're so concerned that while their recidivism rates are not high, if they recidivate with a sexual crime, it is a tremendous impact that we try to avoid. So we've had a history of revoking them for concerning behavior. So that is my guess, is that he had this back and forth. And because he wasn't learning new skills that we're hoping this curriculum will give him, he didn't have other ways to behave. So when those same problems were coming up for him, he may not have had a way to handle them or act differently. So we're hoping that this new curriculum will give them the skills so that when they're faced with those same situations, they have a fork in the road to choose which way to go, that they'll be better skilled and armed to go the right way.
Follow-up and last question. Yes. So how does this population differ from the other populations in OYA?
Could I ask you to clarify different in which way?
Sure,
ma'am.
So you've got children, I guess they are children, who have committed other crimes,
mm-hmm.
and this is the population you're talking with us now, but maybe children who start fires or who are aggressive, attack people, or burglary, whatever the other crimes might be. How does this population differ in terms of how much treatment do they need, how long would they stay in, etc.?
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, some of the differences are some of the social characteristics that they come to us with. Like I mentioned earlier, they have been sexually abused at a much higher rate than the other offenders in our care and custody. They've also been physically abused at a higher rate than the other offenders in our care and custody. Because of their risk to public safety, and by that I mean what Ms. Martin was referring to, which is even though their risk to recidivate is much lower than the other populations, the magnitude and victim impact if they commit a new sex offense is so great that we really weigh that when determining when they're ready to be released. And so historically, their length of stay has been much longer than the other offenders in our care and custody for that reason. Not because the data doesn't tell us that the likelihood of their risk to reoffend is lower, but because of that impact.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Representative Hicks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And our witnesses have touched on something that I would submit is one of the biggest systemic challenges of our juvenile sex offender registration approach, which is basically described by the following scenario. Youth is in DHS placement, foster care setting. Maybe they're developmentally disabled, maybe not, but they commit a sex offense in that foster care setting. So state prosecutes sentenced to OIA, at the end of the process, when the youth is ready for release, you know, OIA really, for all intents and purposes, cannot release back to DHS because of the liability. There aren't foster homes out there who are going to take, you know, the youth back. And so the youth is basically permanently committed, for all intents and purposes, to OIA. There's just no way. And so I wonder if in certain cases, maybe not the one you described, but in certain cases, it's very difficult for OIA really to come up with a community placement because you just can't send them back to DHS. The liability is too high. And so then you do get people bouncing back and forth within the system. And so I wonder if you'd have comments on that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hicks, you're hitting on a very real point that we didn't cover in this presentation, finding that community placement for our sex offenders is a difficult one and a challenging one. And you're absolutely right, the liability and risk that the state assumes when that offender is adjudicated to our care and custody is one we take very seriously. And so that also adds to their length of stay, their extended length of stay, because we aren't going to release them from parole until we believe that they're in a secure and safe and appropriate setting.
Just to follow up, one, it's just that, there really aren't any settings out there to send them, is basically what I'm thinking. I mean, DHS can't take them. It's such a challenge, and I don't know if there is a fix to that, if it's legislative or otherwise, but certainly if there's ideas.
No. Mr. Chair, Representative Hicks, one of the things I will highlight is that our current budget, as it sits on the Senate floor this morning, includes an increase in 103 community placement beds. And we have looked at the population in our care and custody and, of course, have concluded that we were lacking in sex offender placements in the community. So if those beds are funded, then we will be able to create additional resources in the community for those sex offenders and ensure public safety, but manage those sex offenders at a lower cost placement.
Okay. All right, let me just say in the queue, I have Representative Schaffler, Representative Wisnett, and Senator Bonici. Did you have a follow-up to what was just asked, or do you have a general question?
It is a bit of a follow-up, Mr. Chair.
All right, I'm going to let you go first, and then we'll come back
over.
Thank you.
As a follow-up to Representative Hicks, and again, I don't know that this is something that we can solve by legislation, but we've heard a lot about the problems of convicted sex offenders and trying to get a job and an apartment and that sort of thing. So even if they're not in the DHS system, how long do you keep track of them to find out if they're actually able to succeed in society?
Mr. Chair, Senator, we track offenders 3 years beyond their release from our care and custody, and that's the general tracking both in the juvenile system and the adult system. The challenges that sex offenders are faced with are similar if they're juvenile offenders or adult offenders, and that's why I highlighted some of the myths around sex offenders this morning, because of those challenges as it relates to reentry and the ability to find employment, find housing, and for our juvenile population, re-enter back into our high schools. That can also be a challenge for our juvenile sex offenders.
All right. Representative Schaffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's kind of along the lines of what Representative Tomei was hitting on, taking this and applying it to other crimes that kids do because they're just so immature and lost and confused, which I hung out with a lot of guys like that in my youth. So this assessment you use to predict recidivist, non-recidivist, 72% accuracy is amazing. When you were developing this curriculum, did you develop that here in Oregon too? And then can you take that and apply it to youth that are out there breaking the law and just need a helping hand? Can you apply all this there too? And are you doing that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Schaffler, thank you for highlighting that standard, because it really is a gold standard in terms of accuracy and for risk to reoffend. One of the things that we are very appreciative of when our research team developed the ORA and the ORA-V, and it was the research team at the Oregon Youth Authority, is that it relies on data that's already entered in the Juvenile Justice Information System, or as we refer to it, JGIS. And so we will be able to use that tool
for all of the youthful offenders in Oregon. So, as you know, we serve just the state's most delinquent youth. But the state of Oregon receives approximately 34,000 criminal referrals in the juvenile justice system every year. And this tool is an automated one and one that will be able to be applied to all juveniles in the state. And I think that's really an exciting point because historically, we haven't been able to assess risk to reoffend equally. We've used different tools. We've had the RNA at the Oregon Youth Authority. Most counties use the JCP assessment. And so now we'll be able to look and compare offenders equally. I think what that ultimately will help us do is make better placement decisions on the very front end, their first point of contact with the criminal justice system.
And then one more, please. Okay, you got all this figured out for kids that have already offended, broken the law some way, shape, form, or another. Can you take all this information and apply it to some kind of, hate the word, use the words, but social change that would help us potentially troubled youth and avoid them going down this road? Can that, is anybody doing that, or can you do that, or have you already done that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Schaffler, I wish that this was the silver bullet, if you will, and a fix for all. I think a lot of what you're speaking to really needs to be further education to the public generally, further collaboration with the Department of Education, further collaboration with the Department of Human Services. In speaking with Director Aaron Kelly Seal, we have been talking a lot about crossover youth. So how do we highlight the youth that are currently with the Department of Human Services but have those predictive factors that we know are going to lead them to juvenile justice, and how can we better manage that population?
And then one more comment, Mr. Chair. The first thing we can do is make sure every parent has a job in this state. I won't go down my list of things we need to do because Representative Senator Dingfelder is in here and it would just be not that much fun, but that's the first thing we need to do. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for your patience.
You have my pleasure. Representative Wisnett. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question for Director Peters and a question for Mrs. Martin. Director, Measure 11 offenders, if they've completed the treatment and they still are in Kevin Corrections, is that true?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wisnett, that is correct.
Okay, so they're for the full amount of their Measure 11?
That's correct.
Another question, thank you. Mrs. Martin, in your history and development of your curriculum slide, you make the statement that curriculum is intensive and designed to decrease the length of stay. That's true, and we appreciate that since we're responsible for the budget, but I think you're should be designed to correct the behavior or instead of decreasing, that should be the top priority because otherwise we're wasting the dollars. And I know we all get tied up in curriculum being evidence-based, but each person is individual and needs some individual treatment, wouldn't you say?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wisnett, you're absolutely correct on both counts. And although we are developing new tools that we're very excited to implement, including the ORA and the new sex offender curriculum, we will not become calculators. We will not become robots in our managing of these offenders, and we will still continue to look at that individual offender in front of us and case manage that individual youth. These are just additional tools for our staff to do that better.
Thanks for those comments.
All right. Senator Wong.
I believe the co-chair. Do we want to go with the co-chair first?
Co-chair no, right.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Crutcher. Mr. Chair, I'm very interested in getting some more information about your curriculum and also why, if you have an answer, at one time in our history, decades ago, we had one set of beliefs surrounding these types of crimes committed by adults. And over the course of decades, we came to the realization that we were very wrong. And all of the certified experts were very wrong about this type of behavior. And I'm interested in making sure that how we've identified why we were wrong in the 60s and 70s and how that gets us to a place where today we have a higher level of confidence. And I know that's a very big question, so if you wouldn't mind meeting with me and helping me kind of wade through that. I'm no sociologist or psychologist, so we're going to have to go slow and keep it at the kindergarten level, but we can get there.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wong, I'm not a psychologist either, so I'm right there with you. What I can tell you about what I know about research is that research on juvenile sex offending behaviors and treatment really didn't start until about the mid-80s. And so prior to that, it was really based on what we knew about adults. We didn't have any specific knowledge about juveniles. So only for about the past 25 years or so have we really gotten specific knowledge about juvenile offenders, who they are, where they come from, what's their history, and about best works, what works best for treatment over time. So I think that's why we have more confidence now than we did 20 years ago or more about what the treatment needs to be. With that said, it's always changing. And so we're always, that's why we want to work with people that are experts in the field so that we can keep up with the research and make sure that it doesn't get stagnant, that we can always do what's going to give us the best outcomes for those youth.
Thank you.
Co-Chair Barker.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. So many of these are family involved, and so I just was wondering a couple of things. One about placement. Does the juvenile offender go back to the same family where they abuse this, say, a stepbrother, stepsister?
Certainly, Mr. Chair. What I can say is that in many situations, when the youth leave our correctional facilities, they will go to a treatment program or a foster home. The potential is there for them to return to their family home if the right treatment has occurred between themselves, their family members, and the person that they hurt that might live in that household. Obviously, that's a very careful, well-thought-out, well-planned decision before something like that would be undertaken. So it doesn't occur in every case. It's not appropriate in every situation, but there are situations where that can occur.
And a follow-up. I'm assuming somebody other than Oregon Youth Authority does this, but you were showing statistics of the offenders are like 90% have been sexual victims in the past. So who's taking care of these kids that are the victims today? What is being done to head them off so that when they reach that same age, they're not offending? I mean, I've seen statistics, I don't know how old they are, but that said if a kid is molested at 7, then as they get older, they'll molest a 7-year-old.
Mr. Chair, Co-Chair Barker, you're absolutely correct. In most cases, those victims who are still children are case managed through the Department of Human Services. Resources are put around them in the community. And, you know, again, the system is trying to improve that process every day, because as we talk about the crossover youth, you're absolutely right. Those are one of the very clear predictors that a youth will then become involved in the criminal justice system. And so our work around that crossover population is just incredibly important.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. All right. I have two questions. First one is regarding registration. One of the things I think our committees were wanting to get more information, it may be something you need to get back to us, is to, based on your predictors, understanding how we have a little bit more accuracy as to whether you think the current statutes that Josh Nasby went through or are appropriate at this time for the length of time before a youth would be able to, let's say, expunge or remove themselves from from the registration. And I think one of the reasons we've heard, at least on the Senate side, was that when you have that label there, it is going to be very difficult for them to really integrate back into the communities. And so I'm wondering if you could give us some insight either today or in the future as to how you think we may be able to use this as another tool to determine what would be a good public policy, if there should be a change or not.
Mr. Chair, you're of course highlighting the most complicated policy conversation that you've all been faced with, and I certainly wouldn't offer up any opinion that probably hasn't been discussed before the committee today. The information that we have around risk to reoffend and the juvenile justice system as it's created here today, I think can play an important role. So when judges are making sentencing decisions and placement decisions in juvenile court, they actually do that with a community resource team, a CRT, we refer to them. And that team is made up of county juvenile department staff, Oregon Youth Authority staff, often Department of Human Services staff, and they do rely on risk assessment tools to make those decisions. We believe, and the juvenile department directors are very excited to use the ORA in those conversations. And so I think there is a place for that tool on the front end as that judge is making the sentencing and placement decision for these youthful offenders, specifically the sex offenders.
Okay. My last question is one of kind of, I guess, on the finances. Of course, we know where we're at as a state. With this program that's been developed here, it seems to me that if we haven't taken the steps to actually copyright or do whatever protectiveness that we can do and then actually market it and sell it, can you give us any perspective as to where we're at on that?
Mr. Chair, I asked the exact same question yesterday, and I'll let you step in and clarify, but because it is then public, in the public domain and created by the Oregon Youth Authority, it's my understanding we can't copyright it and we can't market it. Would you like to follow up, Ms. Martin?
Mr. Chair, that's the information I've gotten as we've worked on this over the last couple of years with Mr. Cox, who I think you guys know is the assistant director over our field services. We looked into that issue when we first started developing this curriculum. We were told that it was public domain and we could maybe charge for the copying cost, but nothing further.
I'd like, have you actually talked to your DOJ person? It just seems to me there's got to be some way that if we're putting something together, even though it's, I mean, universities, people that are within the public sector are having the ability to do this, and it seems to me, not that we don't want to share it with the world, but at the same time, if we're putting all the time, effort, resources into this to establish it, it seems like we should be able to somehow be compensated for all those skills.
Mr. Chair, I don't know if we've consulted DOJ counsel, but we can certainly do that and get back to
you. I would just suggest that you do it sooner than later, because the more you do out, it's going to be potentially less protective or restricted. Other questions, Senator? Representative Shaw?
I would be possibly interested in us recovering our costs for doing this, but I don't want us making any money. We should give this away. If someone in Iowa or Florida wants to use this tool, I don't want to make a profit on it. I can see recovering our costs, but we should be giving it away. I just really am uncomfortable with selling this or putting it out there and saying, if you have the money, you can have it. If you don't, we're not going to sell it to you. That makes me uncomfortable. Recovering costs, yes, but not making a profit. That makes me feel very uncomfortable.
All right. Other questions, comments? Ladies, thank you very much. I don't think there was anything else that we had on our schedule today. Council, if there's anything else we need to cover. I want to thank everyone that's here on the Senate side. I'm going to go ahead and close the informational hearing for the Senate Judiciary Committee.
Close the House Committee.
Thank you.